few years ago, Ruth Lilly, the heir to a pharmaceutical fortune, left a $100 million bequest to Poetry Magazine. The magazine's publishers have been using some of that money to encourage the practice of memorizing poetry. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg thinks that's a good idea.
Digging into what have to be the deepest coffers of any literary publication in history, the publishers of Poetry Magazine recently joined with the National Endowment for the Arts to hold the first of a series of recitation competitions patterned after the National Spelling Bee. I have to say I'm a little uneasy about that model. The National Spelling Bee is one of those odd competitions that turn an ordinary activity into a high-performance event, like extreme ironing. And when you think of poetry recitation contests, you might have the image of overachiever kids declaiming "The Boy Stood on the Burning Deck" with appropriate gestures while their parents and elocution coaches watch nervously from the audience. But that's probably unfair, and you have to welcome any program that might encourage more learning of poetry by heart, after a half century you could think of as the great forgetting. "In Xanadu did Kubla Khan, I wandered lonely as a cloud. We were very tired, we were very merry." Nowadays, high school graduates don't recognize any of those lines, or the hundreds of others that used to paper the walls of the collective memory. Only a few scraps remain. Students may know the first stanza of The Highwaymen, which comes in handy for teaching about metaphor. Is the poet saying that the moon was really a ghostly galleon? They probably know Shelley's "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings," which makes for a good lesson about irony, not to mention about the futility of big government. And they almost certainly know a bit of "Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening," which is pretty much the last poem left in the American literary canon. That obliteration was already well underway when I was in grade school, and I was spared some of its ravages only because I picked up the habit of memorizing poetry from my dad, who liked to recite to me when I was little, a mix of patriotic ballads like Barbara Frietchie and light verse by the likes of Don Marquis and the sadly forgotten Arthur Guiterman. I've tried to pass on some of these to my daughter Sophie. She does an impressive job with the beginning of "The Cremation of Sam McGee," though she generally loses the track somewhere around "Mushing Our Way Over the Dawson Trail." But that's normal. Unless you're one of those freaks of nature who can soak this stuff up effortlessly, most of what you've got left of the poems you've learned is snips and snatches. "My heart aches, and a something-something pains my sense. I will arise now and go to whatchamacallit. Tatum, tatum, your mum and dad, they may not mean to, but they do." Yet the odd thing is that once you've memorized a poem, you still own it, even after you've forgotten most of the words and have to Google it up the way everybody else does. That's reason enough for learning poems by heart, and there's no need to sully the case for memorization by claiming that it's good for mental discipline or cognitive development. Memorizing poetry does seem to make people a bit better at memorizing poetry, but there's no evidence that the skill carries over to other tasks. For that matter, it's doubtful whether memorization makes you a better writer, either. The former poet laureate Robert Pinsky once suggested that anybody who's memorized a lot of poetry can't fail to write coherent sentences and paragraphs. There's probably some truth to that nowadays, since the only people who know a lot of poetry by heart are the ones who were drawn to it out of a love of language. But the Victorian school children who learned reams of verse at the end of their teacher's canes grew up to write an awful lot of bad prose, most of it happily lost to literary memory. In fact, it's misguided to wax nostalgic for a time when students were required to memorize sentimental ballads and patriotic rousers in the name of character building, and when kids who misbehaved were given 20 lines of poetry to learn as punishment. Memorization back then was a kind of conscription. The whole world learned to march to those regular four-beat rhythms that make poems easy to learn. The progressive educators of the 20th century were right to want to sweep all that away. But they were wrong to dismiss memorization as mindless rote learning, as if the sounds alone communicated nothing by themselves. If you think you can understand poems without feeling them in your body, you're apt to treat them as no more than pretty op-ed pieces. You wind up teaching kids to value "The Road Not Taken" as merely a piece of sage advice about making difficult decisions. I was about 7 or 8 years old when my dad taught me "Scots Wha Hae Wi' Wallace Bled." I had absolutely no idea what the poem was about or even what half the words meant. But I learned something else, how verse can become a physical presence, in Robert Pinsky's words, which operates at the borderline of body and mind. That's an experience that you can only live fully when the poem comes from within, rather than from the page in front of you. I like the way the Victorianist Catherine Robson put this. When we don't learn by heart, the heart doesn't feel the rhythms of poetry as echoes of its own incessant beat.
Jeff Nunberg is a Stanford linguist and author of Going Nuclear: Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times.